everyone, and welcome to minute 34 of season 7 of Movie Room Minute, today podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1985 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Jim O'Kane, the godfather of the Movies by Minute community. Welcome back to the show, Jim.
Thanks for having me on again, Rob. This is quite a week here.
Yeah, well, if you do so well, maybe I'll give you a medallion by the end.
Okay. You
know, we'll see.
I'll have to take out a loan. Let's see. Yeah. Wow. So here we are. I can't get over it. This week is flying by. We're at minute 34.
Yeah. So minute 34 begins with John almost falling off the train and ends with Zeus checking if he's right. So basically, we ended things yesterday with John taking a leap of faith and using his super strength to pick up the grate and then starting to jump down onto the train. And as this minute begins, we see that he lands on the train and sort of slides off to the side and basically is hanging on for his life. Now I don't know the answer to this. Do you think there really are handrails on the top of trains the way that John's hanging onto it?
Only when they need to film Bruce Willis in some of these things.
Okay, that's a fair answer.
It's pretty smooth if you look at most of the train. I mean, they do have that filleting work along the roof, but you're not going to be. You don't make it easy for people to think, hey, anybody could do this. So they're going to stay off of there.
Right. Okay, makes sense. And at this point, John starts sliding off to the side, and he does something really strange in order to try to get into the train. Because it's not 100% clear if he's doing it on purpose or if it just is happening, but he seems like he bangs his head against I don't even know if it's the wall, but he bangs his head twice as the train is moving on something, and then uses that to kick his feet through and break the window. And I don't know if that's the most efficient way to do it, because you'd think that if the train is going, how fast do you think subway trains go?
I would say about 25 miles an hour, maybe.
Okay, enough to give him a concussion. If he's really banging his head, that's what it comes down to. And, he's swings back and then we see the internal shot of the train where, he's broken the glass. Thankfully, nobody was standing next to that area. And, he scoots down into, through the window in order to get into the train itself, to get into the car. Which, again, it's a very strange way to do it. But, hey, if you're John McClane and you know what you're doing, then I guess that makes sense.
And there's no safety glass in the Die Hard verse. So he can just break through it does not look like safety glass to me.
I wouldn't know if it's really safety glass or not, but it turns out it looks like maybe he breaks into the bathroom or something like that, because then he comes out of a door, a side door, and it's a subway. It's not like he's on he's not on the Orient Express where there are bedroom, where you have the bedroom cars and stuff like that. This is basically, you're just on the train. and I think the driver's usually on the other side.
Yeah, so, the driver's usually on the right-hand side there.
Yeah. So, it's a little strange, where he's coming through. But, okay, we'll believe it. It's just a little strange the way that John does these things. Basically, did you notice that as he's getting into the train, we see a green light and a red light? Are you familiar with how that works?
It's usually showing I may be wrong on the New York subway one, but the top one usually shows the next block that's available, and then the block ahead of that, whether or not you're allowed to pass through more than one block. So I'm assuming that it's open till the next signal light, at least for a green on top and a red on the bottom.
Correct. So, yeah, I mean, they've changed the way the signals work over the years and stuff like that. But the whole idea is that, you know, you don't want a train entering an area where there's another train. So basically, red and green lights show whether the block is occupied or vacant. And depending on how many blocks are open, it will limit your speed as to how fast you go. I mean, if I ever end up taking a Pelham 123, which is on my list somewhere down the line, we'll talk a lot more about that type of thing. The idea is that if it's red, it will stop the train, which is also very interesting. You know, like, it automatically, you can't run a red light. Well, actually, if you think about it, in thinking of Pelham 123, they do say that people get written up for running a red light. So there is a way to run them, but it has to. I don't know. I'll have to, if I ever do that as a season, I will have to do more research on how that works. Because according to what I see here, you know, if it's a red light, you get stopped, which, again, is also part of what happens in the movie. But interesting. And basically, John is standing in the subway cab. And did you happen to notice the poster behind him?
No, I did not.
On the right-hand side? So there is a poster that says 1994 Goodwill Games, July 23rd to August 7th. And so it actually made me start thinking that maybe this movie takes place in the summer of 94, not the summer of 95.
Oh.
Because this would technically be an ad for something that's going to happen. You know, it would be strange to have it a year later.
Yeah, unless they didn't take down the sign.
that is possible too. I don't know the answer to that. Now, do you know what the Goodwill Games are, and do you know where they held the 1994 Goodwill Games?
I do not know. It's an alternative to the Olympics, I think, wasn't it?
The Goodwill Games in 1994 were hosted in St. Petersburg in Russia, and the days are correct. It is July 23rd to August 7th. Okay, and it was a multi-sport event created by Ted Turner. And the idea was to improve Soviet Union and U.S. relations during the Cold War period. In 1994, they had 2,000 athletes from 56 different countries that participated in this 16-day event. Boris Yeltsin was president of Russia at the time, and he opened the games. So they give out a total of 171 medals. How many medals do you think Russia won that year?
As percentage wise, I would.
Not percentage. The total number of medals. How many gold medals do you think they won, and how many total medals?
I'm gonna go with.
I don't have the number here of how many medals they give out, but the number is very, very high.
Okay. I would say greater than 40
yes.
gold medals.
They won 68 gold medals.
Wow.
And 171 medals overall. The U.S. was number two that year. And how many do you think they won? How many gold medals and how many?
They were number two, so I would think that they won, I'll go with 48 and 70 overall.
So 37 gold medals and a total of 119.
Okay, wow.
And number three was China, which won 12 gold medals and 27 medals overall.
Wow. How many countries participated?
There were a total of 56 countries.
Wow. feel sorry for the Luxembourgs of the world.
Ukraine, Belarus, Georgia, Armenia, Latvia, Estonia, Uzbekistan, Moldova, and Kazakhstan all won medals in that year. So yeah, in that year in the weightlifting event, There were 5 world records that were broken.
5 in 1 year. Wow.
With the Russian lifters taking every one of the gold medals.
Wow.
And I mean, they have a lot of sports that they use in the Good Will Games. They have archery, athletics, basketball, beach volleyball, boxing, canoeing, cycling, diving, figure skating, football, gymnastics, handball, judo, rowing, short track speed skating.
Talk about wide world of sports.
Seriously, swimming, synchronized swimming, taekwondo, triathlon, volleyball, water polo, weightlifting, wrestling, and yachting. So
yachting, oh, wow.
Just seeing this poster has thrown me for a loop, because it basically is telling me that this movie takes place in 1994, which we had no indication up until now as to when it takes place. So
unless they didn't update. I'll have a tomorrow. I want to talk a little bit more about the subway cars that they're on, but
okay,
that's interesting.
Actually, well, I mean, if they filmed this movie in the fall of 94, so that would also make sense, I guess you could say.
Yeah, you know,
that they hadn't taken the poster down, and no one paid any attention to it.
Nobody said, "Yeah, wait a minute, this might limit us."
Yeah. Interesting. And then John starts moving through the through the car, and he goes, "Whoa, excuse me, hey, just get out of the way, please." And you know, he starts looking for the bomb, and you know, just trying to keep people from bothering him, basically. And then first of all, this is a great shot of the Twin Towers.
Yeah, that's a beautiful shot.
And they play some very eerie music. I mean, this movie, they show the Twin Towers a lot, and it feels ominous, you know. And obviously, when they filmed it, they had no clue of how ominous it would really be. But it's just very weird that the music they play there is. And then we get a shot of Zeus as he's like looking up, and first of all, it's a great shot because it's an overhead shot of him as he's like looking up, amazed at you know, how close he is to the World Trade Center. And then he almost hits a truck as he's doing this, you know. He's not paying attention as much as he probably should. And we actually see a sign of the what street he's on. He's on Nassau Street.
Yes,
you have the Federal Hall National Memorial there. The Stock Exchange building is not. It basically runs through the financial district of New York. It goes from the southern end is Broad and Wall Street, and the northern end goes up to Spruce Street at Pace University, which is at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge. And basically, it runs parallel to Broadway and Park through the whole thing. Do you know what the original name of Nassau Street was?
I do not.
It was known as Kip Street.
Kip.
Which it was named after a Dutch settler family. And then they decided to change the name and use the name after the royal family of the Netherlands, the House of Orange Nassau.
Nassau, that's right, yeah. That's what I figured it was. I thought that Nassau might have been the original name because of Orange Nassau, you know, the old New Amsterdam area. But that's interesting that it's a renaming even way back then.
Yeah. And it borders on the Fulton Nassau Historic District, which the original headquarters of the New York Times and the New York Daily Times were located there until they moved to Park Row. You know, at that time, the New York Times, or which was known as the New York Daily Times, became the first building to have its own entire workforce. So, yeah. And at this point, you know, Zeus then gets a jolt because we hear the door open behind him. And if you pay attention in the few seconds right before the door opens, you can actually see the actor walk towards the cab.
Okay.
And you can see who it is. And so a man enters the cab, and this is an actor played by Bill Cux, K-U-X. And he's listed in the credits as business Business Guy Taxi. He was born in June of 1953. And he actually only has 16 IMDb credits, including this movie. And basically, he has done a lot more stage acting than acting, you know, on the screen.
So this was his cinematic peak?
Probably. most of the things he was in were TV shows, just like one episode and stuff like that. And he says, 112 Wall Street. Wait, this isn't a taxi. You don't understand. Your light's on. I'll make it simple. 112 Wall Street, or I'll have your medallion suspended. What? You don't like white people?
Stir that pot, Zeus, yeah.
That's right. Zeus looks at him and goes, 112 Wall Street? So, I mean, I'm not as familiar with the geography of New York, but I always thought that the World Trade Center was further south, you know, because...
It's north of the Battery. Like, the Battery is the southernmost point of Manhattan, and Battery Park City to the west is fill dirt that was there from digging a hole to make the World Trade Center. So there's a lot more there. Manhattan has moved south as it's built up, because all those tall buildings that you see in Manhattan, the dirt for the basements had to go somewhere, and most of it went south and west and filled in and created the pier system that's out there. Like I said earlier, Battery Park City, Fulton Street, the Fish Market, and things like that, all that's built over landfill. So World Trade Center is further north than most people would imagine. You see it in a lot of pictures, and you see the tip of Manhattan, but there's quite a few blocks between the Battery and Hudson Street would be Reed Street would be about the north end of where the World Trade Center was. The center part of old New York, the New Amsterdam portion where Wall Street is and all these Dutch name streets, the named streets, it's pretty thick in that section, but it's difficult to get around. It's difficult to get around by car. I think from where they're at, if they're at, they're on Nassau Street, it'd probably be easier for the guy to just walk over to Wall Street where he's going. He said 112 Wall Street. That's kind of like the very east end of Wall Street. It's opposite where World Trade Center is on the west side, and where he wants to go is Wall Street, almost to Fulton Street. So I don't understand why he would take a cab there. It probably the amount of time it would take sitting in a cab. It would be a lot easier for him to just walk. It's a sunny day. It's nice weather and stuff. But I guess he's used to being driven around, so he's gonna pay Sam Jackson to take him to 112 Wall Street.
Right. Now, he mentions that I'll suspend your medallion. So we mentioned this at the beginning of today's episode. So what is a medallion, and how much does a medallion cost?
Wow, that's such a great it's been the news story for the past 10 or 15 years, that medallions are like the tulip tray. There's very few. What a medallion is, it's a license to use a taxi in New York and in other cities. And Philadelphia has them, Chicago, Boston, they all have them. And the way that these different cities control traffic for commercial vehicles is they limit the number of medallions that are distributed so that you can run so many taxis with so many medallions. And so since they limit the supply of medallions, demand was great. So they would go for hundreds of thousands. I think they went up to like $500,000 at the height of it. People would take out mortgages on their house and use the money to buy medallions and then pay them off as they were doing their runs as a hack. But then Uber came along and it kind of wrecked the whole medallion market, and now I don't think they're worth a tenth of that. A lot of people went bankrupt because they were in, you know, they're underwater on their loans for a medallion that wasn't worth what they had paid for it. I don't know. Right. Do you know how much they're going for nowadays? I don't know what the price is for a medallion.
Yeah, so we'll get there in a second. So like you said, there are approximately there are five big cities that use it. You have New York, Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, and San Francisco. So in Boston, at the height in 2014, the price was $700,000.
Wow.
And now it is at 40,000.
Ouch.
It's really moved down to what they say is a 95% loss. In Chicago, the total value of all of them was all of the medallions that they had in the city was $2.5 billion in 2013. And the medallion prices range between $87,000 and $385,000. Then the prices started going down, and now it's approximately $30,000 in Chicago. Then Philadelphia, in 2005, it had reached about $80,000. And now it's bumped down to about $50,000. Mm. And San Francisco, at one point it was $250,000. And that's also, much cheaper nowadays because, obviously, the whole idea of Ubers. So New York, the original value in the 1960s was about $25,000. And the price kept rising. And it reached the point where in 2005, it was $375,000. In 2010, it hit $600,000. And in 2013, it was over $1 million.
Wow.
And then the prices started dropping. In 2015, it reached $650,000. And then after 2018, it dropped down to $200,000. They even auctioned, they were auctioning off medallions in the end of the teens in 2019. And they were selling them for about $135,000, $138,000. And basically they were trying to raffle off 16, and only three of them were bought. The other 13 weren't bought. And
yeah, it's like trying to corner the payphone market at this point. It's just like, why would you have a medallion if you can just sign up for Lyft or Uber or one of those things and not have to pay for a medallion?
That's right. And a lot of cab drivers had to declare bankruptcy because they couldn't afford them anymore. And there's a company called Marble Gate Management LLC, which is the largest holder of New York City medallion loans. They wrote off $70 million of debt.
Ouch.
from drivers that could no longer pay for it.
So, wow.
Yeah, the medallion is not worth as much as it used to be. This is not your father's medallion.
Yeah, not your father's yellow cab, yeah.
That's right. All right, so that's how this minute ends, with Zeus making sure. You sure you want to go to 112 Wall Street? And we'll have to see tomorrow how that trip goes for them.
fun.
That's right. So the script continues with the subway train passes beneath him, still moving slowly, accelerating into the tunnel, and McClane releases his grip, falling onto the roof of the driver's cab. The subway driver looks up, astonished at McClane outside, clinging to the door of the driver's car, banging on the window. The driver opens the door. McClane slides inside. He flips out his detective shield. Just keep driving and stay on schedule. McClane opens the back door of the driver's compartment and enters the first subway car. Then this is the taxi. Zeus at the wheel flies through traffic. Zeus looks up to the windshield at Wall Street's World Trade Center, looming over the skyline just ahead. Zeus lowers his eyes to the street. Oh, my God, a tractor trailer is in the intersection ahead of him. Zeus slams on the brakes. The taxi screeches to a stop at the light. Zeus nervously taps his fingers on the wheel, waiting for the truck to make the corner. Suddenly, the back seat door of the taxi opens. Zeus whirls around, staring at a guy in a business suit sitting in the back seat. Zeus has picked up a passenger, and he's a snotty guy. 112 Wall Street, please. You got to get out, sir. No, your light's on. Let me make this simple. Take me to Wall Street, or I'll have your medallion suspended. What? You don't like white people? Zeus glares at the guy, sighs. Fine. 112 Wall Street it is. again, it flows much better in the movie than what they do here. So, so every Thursday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Revenge Edition, where my guests will give some sort of story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure. Something's happened to them over the course of their life that is somehow related to either revenge or sibling rivalry or something like that. So, Jimmy, you got a story for us?
Well, I'm an only child, so I don't have any good sibling stories, but I do have a good story about another Rob I knew, a good friend of mine, Rob Renfro, who is no longer with us, but was an excellent musician. I think if he were still around, he'd probably be doing Movies by Minutes podcast. But Rob was a great musician. He wrote some soundtracks for a Matthew Broderick movie called 1918, and he also did the music for A Trip to Bountiful. And he was one of those kind of people. I mean, you meet musicians every once in a while that it comes so naturally to them that the music just comes right out of their hands when they sit down at a piano and roll through. This was back in, as I said, the scene is 1983. PCs are brand spanking new. There's all kinds of different kinds out there. There's Apples and Amigas and Commodores and all those, and when back in the day, you used to go to computer stores where they had a whole panoply of different models of computers, and the Amiga had just come out. We were at a store in Dallas, and Rob was looking at this Amiga, which was built around music. It could play basically a synthesizer with a keyboard. And so we were sitting playing around, and he could picture musical notes in his head. He was typing in. He brought up a music program that had five staffs, and you could program whatever voices or instruments you wanted on it. And we were just sitting there in the back of this computer place while he was typing in some stuff to see how it would work. And this rather annoyed salesman came up and said, "Excuse me, fellas, if these computers are for sale, they're not for playing around with." And he goes, "We really don't want you messing with the computers." So I said, "Okay, fine." And my friend Rob looked at the fellow, and so he pressed the enter key, and the speakers that were next to him started playing the opening flute notes of Strawberry Fields Forever, and it went into the big power guitar chord, and it started playing Strawberry Fields Forever multi-track and everything. It's just beautiful music coming out of it. And the salesman was looking at the computer, and he said, "Oh, I've got to go get a diskette and save this." And so my friend Rob reached over to the power button and said, "Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to bother your computer." And he pressed the power button and turned it off, losing the program that he had just written, the beautiful score. So it's like, well, you asked us not to touch it, so okay, sorry to offend you. And the guy could have had a beautiful demo program for free on his computer, but I wouldn't call it exactly revenge, but it was more natural consequences of being unkind. So and I that's my good subtle revenge story.
All right, great, excellent. I like that story. It reminds me of Star Trek IV, when after Scotty types everything up on the computer and says, "Well, I can hit delete."
Yeah, exactly. That's what it felt like. About, and it's roughly in the same years.
Exactly, translucent aluminum.
Yeah, aluminum. Yeah, there you go.
Wow. All right, great. All right, so Jim, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Jim McCain?
Sure. When you're done here, I mean, you really need to listen to all of Rob's show here. But once you're done, you can go over and listen to our show, which is currently playing October Sky Minute, where we go over the 1999 Joe Johnston directed Universal feature. It's got Jake Gyllenhaal in it, Laura Dern. They're not on our show yet, but they may be by the time we're there. They haven't said no yet to us. So we're trying to get Jake and we're trying to get Laura on. But we do have Chris Cooper, Natalie Cannady, Elliot Baskin, Chris Cooper. I said Chris Cooper already. David Dwyer.
He's on there twice.
Yeah. See, he's been on several times. Yeah. It's just they're everywhere. Also, director Joe Johnston, producer Larry Franco, screenwriter Lewis Kolick and Homer Hickam himself, the subject and author of Rocket Boys, which later became October Sky, is on our show. So a lot of great guests, a lot of interesting topics. So join us when you're done here at OctoberSkyMinute.com.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Run Minute. You can find me on my website, MovieRunMinute.com. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. Or you can send me an email to MovieRobMinute@MovieRob.net. So, Jimmy, you feel like coming back in tomorrow to finish off the week?
Let's polish this off. Off to 112 Wall Street we go.
All right. Put your seatbelt on. But until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Johnny comes marching home again. Hoorah, hoorah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then. Hoorah, hoorah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout. The ladies, they will all turn out. And we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.